Enigma, firebrand, visionary. Three perspectives on one man, Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. His followers have been clashing with Iraqi security for 3 days now, especially in the southern city of Basra, a Shiite stronghold. Iraq's prime minister has called for Sadr and his followers to lay down their weapons by tomorrow. Sadr has asked the prime minister to leave Basra. Yeah, he told the prime minister to get out, threatening civil disobedience. Sadr has been leading his followers and his Mehdi army in a ceasefire, which began in August of 2007, and he's credited with reducing some of the violence in Iraq. His power has grown because he can get results. Why can he get results? Because of his family history in the region, his own charisma, and his ability to engage displaced and disgruntled Iraqis. In Newsweek magazine, there is a profile of al-Sadr written by Babak Digampiche. He is the Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek. Babak, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay, we have a little bit of a delay so our listeners can understand what's going on. I do want to start with the news of the day. There's a curfew in Basra. Schools and universities are closed. What happened that led al-Sadr's followers to be in a clash so heavily with Iraqi security?
Well, it was really the Iraqi security forces that started this round of fighting. Prime Minister, Mr. Maliki, went down to Basra with the Ministers of Interior and Defense. My understanding from sources that I've talked to is that they had gone down to discuss a security plan for the city, and whether they had really sort of thought it out and planned it out or not, they did begin to execute that security plan, and the security forces pushed out into neighborhoods where where the Mehdi army, the fighters loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr are dominant, and that really kicked off the fighting.
So does this pushing into these areas and the fighting backed by the Mehdi army, does this mean the ceasefire is over, or is this an isolated incident?
Well, as far as Sadr's supporters, his political representatives in parliament have come out and said that the ceasefire is still in place. There was a statement read by one of Sadr's representatives, a cleric named Hazem al-Araji, down in Najaf a couple of days ago, and he also reiterated that the ceasefire was still in place. So, officially the line is that the ceasefire is still in place, but it does seem that, that there are several, commanders or hundreds of his supporters who may not be listening to it, because there is fighting in Baghdad, there is fighting in Basra still, and there are reports of fighting in a number of smaller cities like Hilla, Kut, Amara, Diwaniya also.
Now, you write in your piece in Newsweek, though, that Sadr is looking to sort of, I don't know if streamline's the right word, but to purge his Mahdi army, his followers, of people who are troublemakers. Could you discuss a little bit about the thought process behind this, why he would do this, why he wouldn't just want numbers, why he wants quality over quantity?
Sure. In the past couple of years, there has been a fracturing or a splintering of the supporters of Sadr, especially within the military side of his movement, within the Mehdi army. And there are a number of commanders who aren't thought to be really following his orders anymore. And these are the elements that the U.S. military refers to as the rogue Jaish al-Mahdi. And that was really the target of this cleansing or purging of the movement. And in the past year, we've seen that particularly in the past 6 months, since the ceasefire has been announced, we've seen that there have been elements of Sadr's own movement who have targeted these rogue commanders and tried to get them out. So in a way, they don't give the cleric a bad name. But with this current operation, it seems to have quickly escalated to such a level that Sadr really can't sort of back off and say it's a rogue element. So it still remains to be seen how it's all going to play out.
It's interesting you said, you mentioned his public face, because in one of your articles, you described al-Sadr's agreeing to a ceasefire as partly a PR move. Why would that be a PR move?
It was. Actually, it's a bit of sort of inside baseball within the Shia community in Iraq. It goes back to a Shia religious festival called the Shabaniya last August. It commemorates the birth of the Imam Mahdi, which Sadr's Mehdi army is named after. And during that festival in Karbala, there were clashes between various militant factions, or there were clashes between militiamen and the guards at the two shrines there in Karbala. And there was a government investigation, and they found that the people who were really causing the problems were Sadr's supporters. So that was one of the main reasons that that Sadr called for the ceasefire, because it looked really bad among the Shia community that his followers were this sort of out of control, and even within a Shia religious festival, they couldn't control themselves and started to file.
We're speaking with Babak Digampiche, the Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek, about Muqtada al-Sadr. We've been talking mostly about the news of the past 72 hours. I do want to back up a little bit and talk about Sadr's history. He comes from a long line of influential Shiite clerics, including his father, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, who was murdered during Saddam Hussein's regime. How does this family history play into his political influence now?
Well, really more than many of the other Shia clerics, Sadr's family name, they have a lot of street cred amongst ordinary Iraqis, because as you mentioned, his father, Muhammad Sadiq Sadr, was here during Saddam's regime. He was thought to be murdered by Saddam's intelligence apparatus. And, while there are a lot of other prominent clerics who are now back from exile, there were many of them who spent time in Iran or Syria during the really hard days of Saddam's rule. So when they came back, they didn't have nearly the same amount of street support that Sadr's family and himself that he did either.
And you've reported he's actually studying to become an even more powerful figure, perhaps working towards becoming an ayatollah. How is he doing this, and how much more influential would this make him if he became an ayatollah?
That's right. What we're hearing from sources within his own movement and sources in Najaf is that he is trying to sort of beef up his religious credentials. He really isn't that senior of a cleric at the moment. He left off his studies to a certain extent after the U.S. invasion in 2003. But we've heard that in the past year or so, he has been studying partly through the internet, actually, and with the help of some other clerics. One of the clerics that has been mentioned is a prominent Iraqi-born cleric who is now a prominent politician in Iran. And if he does reach the status of ayatollah, that would give him even more power to sort of issue religious decrees, and it would also bolster his political status as well. It would just give him a lot more pull, basically, with the Iraqi street.
Babak Digampiche is the Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek. Thanks for sharing your reporting, Babak. Be safe.
Thank you.